With my welcome to BBS, I also welcome my listeners. And actually, I'm very much thrilled to welcome my guest, Mr. Willis Lum. And the show today will be devoted to most precious and most exotic world. We're going to talk about horses and specifically about wild horses. I will introduce in a little bit more detail Mr. Willis Lum, and will frankly share with you my discovery of this wonderful person whose passion and courage allows these fantastic animals not only to survive, but prosper and have a very bright future. We also, however, will talk about some problems. We will talk about some sadness, because nothing in life is smooth and shiny, but with devotion like Willis Lum demonstrates and expresses, and with a public support, and with the support of listeners like this program will have, we all have a very strong hope that the future of this world of horses will be well-nourished and very well-preserved. So on this note, I will briefly walk you through how indeed I personally came to the point and why my interest personally was leading to this fantastic world. After all, I'm a musician and educator with some other little ends to it. But as I said in my very, very first show, everything is connected in life. And the more connections we have, the richer we are inside. So following this as much as I can, I came across with some idea that indeed musical rhythm and horses walk and movements are in such a harmony. And then going deeper, I learned more about this world. And then one day I found myself in some questions. I wasn't shy, and I decided to write a little email to a gentleman by name Willis Lum. Well, that was quite a discovery. I touched on an absolutely huge, giant world where I understand Mr. Willis Lum has one of the most predominant role. So I learned a little bit about KBR, which is kicking back range history. I also learned that led to another organization, which is locating in Nevada also. It's called Community of Knudsen. And I also learned that actually Nevada is not only famous for Las Vegas. So on this note, I will introduce my very special guest, Mr. Willis Lum, and I will ask him first question: what brought him to the world of horses?
Well, good afternoon, Lena, and thank you for inviting me on your show. Horses are really amazing creatures, and for many years I didn't have a lot to do with horses, and to be honest, I got into horses because I bought some ranch property, and part of it was I had to take an old horse that the people had. And that started my experience with horses. And I had some very influential friends along the way that taught me a lot about horses, which ultimately led me through many twists and turns to my passion regarding America's wild free-roaming horses. And now, you know, from somewhat of a suburban guy, I live out in the wild horse range, and it's wonderful to have your morning cup of coffee and look out the back window and see wild horses going by.
Well, I'm so glad that besides New York Times, you had that beautiful picture. I wanted to ask you, since we have actually more time than I was afraid we will not have, I'd like to extend some of my questions. And I'm actually very thankful because you yourself, in the process of communication, focused my attention to certain hot points to it. So I want to actually came to first question, what is exactly difference between regular horses and wild horses? And what is the wild horse from the points of view of their characteristics, how specifically different they are from the regular horse?
Well, a wild horse is sort of unique in the sense, I mean, they're all related, of course, but the wild horse is a product of many generations of horses that have survived on their own out on some fairly inhospitable high desert range. Most of the horses in the United States actually live in Nevada, and the, most of Nevada is very rural and very dry and very desert-like and very rocky. We're a state that has more mountain ranges, actually, than any other state in the Union. So we are not, for the most part, like what visitors to Las Vegas would expect. These horses have had to make do with very limited resources, and the strongest survive, and the smartest survive, and it is that's the product that makes a wild horse, as opposed to a domestic horse that's been bred for specific characteristics that are compatible with the different uses that we would want as equestrians, for example.
Well, to still bring few specific things, wild horses, in terms of a history, when for the first time they've been noticed, where this strong separation took place between regular horses and wild horses?
Well, one of the things that's sort of interesting is we have to realize that wild horses actually, the modern horse actually evolved in North America and migrated into Asia and Europe, and then eventually we believe became extinct in North America. The Iberian horses, which are actually Portuguese, they're called Spanish Mustangs because they were brought over by the Spanish conquistadores. But the Iberian horses appeared here, I think, around the 1600s. The Spanish and missionaries and other people had horses, and some of them got out. Some of them were only used periodically and were left out because in the early days there was not the great ability to grow and transport hay, So these populations from these original horses spread throughout a great deal of the West. And, of course, then as Europeans brought over other breeds of horses, those horses also had individuals that either were let loose or escaped or were turned out to graze on their own and intermixed with the original Spanish populations. If you do DNA work on these horses, most of the wild horses out there will trace back to some extent to some markers that are consistent with the original ancient Iberian horses. So that's kind of a cool thing. I mean, some of these herds, especially if they're not too polluted, you might say, by a lot of domestic stock over hundreds of years, they really are a look back at some of the really ancient horses as far as the New World's timeline is concerned.
We are going to touch on some legal issues, and it is so wonderful to have you with your knowledge and this clarification, describing actually this very painful conflict. So I just give a little promise here, standing still with my questions about wild horses. There was a legal standing on a federal lands regarding wild horses. What does it mean?
In 1971, Congress unanimously, believe it or not, you can't imagine Congress unanimously passing
anything. No, cannot.
They unanimously passed a law that was commonly known as the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act. And what Congress had determined, and in fact, in the law, it stated that the wild free roaming horses and burros are living symbols of the historic and pioneer spirit of the West, and that they contribute to the diversity of life forms within the nation and enrich the lives of the American people. Well, they identified that these horses were special, and they identified certain public lands, you know, that were owned by the federal government, and determined that those horses had protected standing on those lands where they were found when the act was passed. So it doesn't mean that they're the only animals that can be on those lands, but those animals did have legal standing. You just couldn't come remove those horses if you felt like it, because Congress said they belonged there.
And, of course, we will talk extensively about BLM, which is Bureau of Land Management, and you will walk us through with all this intricacy of that situation. But, again, I like to ask you, in terms of horses, perhaps in a historic sense, how much of the international collaboration took place between Europe, Eastern Europe, and America? Are there similar laws? Are there similar traditions in breeding? Any kind of a similarity, and maybe some laws supporting each other?
Well, you know, that's sort of an interesting question that I hadn't really put much thought into. You know, when the Western herds are actually made up of a number of different origins of horses. There are areas, for example, that have a lot of Basque Curlies, you know, and that's an Eastern European horse. There are some herds that represent more of the Morgan or Thoroughbred appearance, because those were activities that took place historically in the West where those particular types of horses were used. And, of course, we know that the modern wild horse, for the most part, is the progeny of, you know, many ancestors, many generations back, of horses that actually built the West. You know, the West was built on and America was built on the backs of horses before the invention of the steam engine and the gasoline engine. So, you know, we could go 100 different directions probably to look at the different histories of different horses from different areas, because they're quite literally hundreds of herd areas. And we can look back at a great deal of Europe and Asia when we see some of these things, or even Africa, the Barbary Coast horses. There are horses that have, they're related in some way to the Arabians, you know, so... I mean, this is amazing. You could probably spend a week discussing all the possible permutations here.
Yeah, I think you've been too modest about this. You know, just the thought, and I'm not sure there is validity to it, but perhaps in the 19th century, because transportation and the wars, and just one can name it, a horse was the... almost like a member of the world, a member of the family, because horse would be taking us to places. It's an entertainment, and it's, as I said, in a battlefield. I think it was, in a natural way, more of a protection and more of an instinct connection between human and the horse, when today we have to worry about laws. We have to worry about this preservation, and we have to be much more alert for this for the connection between human and the horse. Would
Absolutely.
You find that this, indeed, because of the technology, because we have four wheels, horses now demand more of law protection, and we gradually go into, of course, logistic of it?
I think you're quite right. The thing that I see is, in looking back over, you know, our relationship with the horse, as you said, in the 18th and 19th centuries, your survival may have been dependent upon your horse and how well you took care of the horse. Definitely, in many cases, your ability to prosper was dependent upon the horse. And you know, our relationship with those animals were codependent. They depended on us, and we depended on them. And as you point out, now that we're in a technical age, the horse is more of a, I don't know, a historical artifact or an icon of an earlier age. So the value that we place on the horse is distinctively different for most people, I suppose, unless you're Amish. you know, and you still live in the world of horses, and perhaps maybe some of those folks are better off than we are, you know, but it doesn't mean that we have to detach our emotions from the horse, that the horses don't have value to us, and the horses don't connect us back with our past.
I'm apologizing. I will jump in when you said detach. I think even more so in our technology world, we can draw so much more emotions and energy from beauty. And if anything, we should be even more grateful that this very devoted to us animal becoming even more precious. Again, apologizing, jumping in, but you touched such a sensitive, beautiful point, and I just wanted to stress this.
Well, thank you. You know what? If one of the things that we can still do, and I'm not opposed to technology. Technology has done wonderful things for us, but we can't be so myopic that we follow completely into technology and we forget the arts and we forget nature and we forget some of these other things that are actually such significant components of our world. We have people from all over the world that come out onto the Wild Horse Range here, and they go out and they actually see these horses, and virtually all of them. And it doesn't matter if you're a retired school teacher or a baroness from Austria, they walk away with this just profound feeling after seeing this, because, you know, this is sort of an almost primal connectivity, which to me, you know, rounds out my personality, and I think it rounds out the personal experiences of a lot of people. The sad part is that, you know, we don't have room to bring 300 million people over to see horses, but just knowing that they're out there and preserving the ability for people to come out onto the Wild Horse Range in a non-invasive way and see nature and the horses and something that's just so dramatic, you know, and basically it's free. You don't have to pay admission to, you know, if you can make it out to see these things. You know,
yes,
so we should preserve them.
Yes, we should remind people more often that spirit is free, just treasure it.
Yes, absolutely.
I will come to more of a technical question. Are these horses protected by law? What is this controversy over the wild horses?
Well, one of the things that we have to remember is most of our public lands are preserved and maintained for what's called multiple use. That means that if there's minerals, then people can be permitted to extract the minerals or extract energy sources, oil and coal, run solar energy facilities, use it for recreation, use some of these lands for the raising of livestock. So there are multiple uses, and the horses are one component of those multiple uses. And as you know, anytime we have multiple uses, you're going to have competition between those uses for the resources that are on that land. And the BLM's responsibility, and it's not necessarily an easy task, is to fairly allocate those resources so that if you have, say, cattle ranchers and a mine operation and some other activities and wild horses, that all those things can be, those activities can take place on these public lands while at the same time trying to maintain a thriving ecological balance for wildlife to not create pollution problems from some of the industrial activities that take place. So it becomes a very complicated issue very rapidly, for which a lot of different laws start poking in, whether they're environmental protection laws or wildlife protection laws, endangered species laws. So managing wild horses, while the concept seems real simple, let the horses out there and you know, try to keep them out of trouble, there's all this other red tape that comes in and makes it very complicated. And, of course, then you have many different opinions as to how this management should take place. And when you have different opinions, then you're going to have you're going to form up basically different sides or different viewpoints. And here we have the controversy.
Yes, and we certainly will touch more on that during our conversation. I just wanted to be clear to our listeners that the abbreviation, which is sound like BLM, stands for Bureau of Land Management. And I wanted to say that someone who just joined us, we are having a conversation about history of horses and particularly wild horses. And my special guest today is Willis Lum, who dedicated his life, devoted his love for horses and wild horses. In fact, I'm a little doubt if he has enough time for love for people, but judging by energy of his voice and knowing that he's a very gifted musician as well, which we will discover a little later in the program, I don't doubt that this very special person has energy and love for the world as a whole. On this, I'd like to ask you next question, which actually came to my mind some time ago. I was stunned by learning that there is a huge number of horses. It's a 25,000 horses and burros still free roaming. Can you please comment on that? And could you tell us also, are they roaming happily, or they need some kind of a extra climate requirements? What kind of a life do they have?
Well, for the most part, I think the wild free-roaming horses and burros, and I think 25,000 is a fairly reasonable estimate. And, you know, for your listeners, the reason that it's difficult to get an exact handle on it is there's actually more than one agency. There are several agencies that in different locations have responsibilities for the horses. We always tend to talk about the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, because by far they're the largest agency that handles horses. But you've got all these different statistics being generated by different entities. So we feel that 25,000 is probably a good number, spread over about 11 western states. There also happen to be wild horses on the East Coast, on the Barrier Islands in Virginia and North Carolina and Georgia. But for the most part, we're talking about the ones on the western landscape. And for the most part, the horse herds are actually in pretty good shape. These horses seem to enjoy being wild, free-roaming horses. One of the things we do have to realize, though, in Nevada, it's, aside from having more mountains, it's the driest state in the United States. Some areas get 3 inches of rainfall or less per year, and we can have some rather radical shifts in microclimates from one region to the next, depending upon a variety of factors. So you can have a sustainable area for horses and for other activities that within about a one-year period can really turn bad. So aside from the fact that the Bureau of Land Management needs to manage populations, or try to keep a balance, I should say, between the populations and the resources, they also have to stay ahead of some of these climatic changes, or in these little microclimates, where in one area, you know, it can be lush and green as far as a desert range could be, which probably to Easterners would look pretty brown. To another area, maybe 30 miles away, would be just total sand. It's dried out because it didn't get any rain for many months. Now that we have basically dissected and transected the West with fencing and roads and so forth, the herds can't migrate like they might have 150, 200 years ago. If conditions turned bad, you know, the animals would move into a more desirable location and readjust their grazing pressure. So while in total, looking at the big picture, the horses and the horse herds and the burros are in generally pretty good shape, that doesn't mean that you're not going to see probably several times a year some sort of an emergency situation where one of the agencies has to go out and bring in animals. Or like in our location, what we try to do is we get projects going where we actually haul water up where water sources have failed, as long as there's still grass available for the animals to eat. There's a lot of different mitigation efforts that can take place, but it does take knowing what's going on out on the range. If you're responsible for animals, you need to know what's going on out there. And being a little bit resourceful so that you can try to mitigate the problem in the least intrusive and the least disrupted manner possible.
Since you're talking about population and condition, I think the next logical question will be something which when I read about this, I got very nervous, a little bit of emotional, because the verb in the description of the horse life was used removed. What does it mean, removed from Western lands? What is a removal? What type of a removal that is, and why it takes place?
Well, the BLM is charged with the responsibility of maintaining the horse herds and controlling the horse herds in a way that preserves a thriving ecological balance. Now, a lot of us have different interpretations of what that means and what that should produce as far as activities by BLM. BLM's main tool for keeping a balance between horses and resources is estimating when populations reach the upper limit of what a particular area where horses are allowed can sustain. And then they go in and they remove a portion of that herd of horses, perhaps 30% to 40%, down to what's established as a minimal viable population level. So in other words, an area could have 1,200 horses, and they may go out and remove 600 or 700 horses and then allow the residual population that's left behind to go ahead and fill that environment again. We have a few problems with that. One is that removing large numbers of horses at one time, even under the best circumstances, is an inherently dangerous process. And although, you know, even being a horse out in the wild is an inherently dangerous process, it's a difficult life and they're well suited for, but there's predators and other things. But now we're imposing our own, you know, sort of mechanical activities in there. So there's a risk employed when the agencies go out with helicopters and they herd these horses into trap corrals and they haul them off. So part of our difference in perspective is that we feel that especially like aerial gather should be more of a last resort option, not a first resort option. However, in this part of the discussion, we're talking about what removal entails. Well, these horses will be brought in off the range. Most of them will never go back on the range. They're going to go to either a federally owned or a federally contracted facility where they'll be vaccinated and checked for disease and so forth. And eventually, the intent was to prepare them to be turned over to private adopters. In other words, you would like to have a wild horse and you would like to basically gentle it and either have it as a pet or as a saddle horse. You know, and that was a realistic concept. There are a lot of people that enjoy taking, you know, a wild free roaming horse. Usually they're very athletic and they're pretty intelligent because they had to survive based on their own physical abilities and their own minds, and develop a relationship with the horse. And the successful people actually develop relationships with their horses. They're not really intimidated just because we can walk around on two legs. And these horses can turn out to be wonderful saddle horses. People use them for show horses. The Border Patrol, actually, and some of the law enforcement agencies, and even the Army, uses some of the horses either for ceremonial or like with the Border Patrol and with law enforcement agencies as workhorses. You know, so the idea was that you take the excess horses and you you turn them over to the private sector, which, of course, at that point, every time someone takes a horse home, they're making a conscious decision to divert part of their disposable income into maintaining that horse. And that money goes directly into the local agricultural economy. It's a whole lot different economic model than if we go out and we buy foreign-made consumer products. So it was really originally a good idea, but it sort of kind of drifted off track.
You know, you touched upon something which I mentioned in the beginning, but very briefly. There is an organization which called LRTC, Least Resistance Training Concepts. And I'd like for you to tell us, are these organizations are readily available to people who want to get some training, who will be competent to take care of the horses. Are these offices or agencies, are they still popular?
Yeah, they are. Right now, BLM's sort of going off in a little different direction. But in the late 1990s, there was the different horse advocacy groups, several of them kind of got together, and we were looking at the issue that BLM's trying to place horses with adopters, and one of the biggest difficulties was that if you were going to go, and let's say you go to an adoption, BLM would take 100 horses out to fairgrounds in a semi-rural area. People would come and look at the horses, and they could adopt the horses for a very reasonable fee. The string that was attached was you didn't legally own that horse until you proved to the BLM that you took care of that horse properly for a year. But you could get a real value in a horse. So people would go out there, and they would look at these horses, and some of them would impulsively adopt horses without having a realistic expectation of what it was to bring a wild animal home and have it in the corral in your backyard. And we saw quite a few instances where it really didn't work out. The adopter had a bad experience, and the horse probably had a bad experience, and ultimately the horse went back to BLM. So we recognized two things. One is we needed to get information out to the public before they even considered adopting. And what we needed to do is create sort of a realistic expectation. Here's what you could be expected to have when you get the horse home. This is the kind of time you need to spend. These are the kinds of skills that you need to develop. And we've had novices that have been extremely successful with horses, so you don't have to be a horse expert to take a wild horse home. But you needed to know what to expect, and you needed to know what you needed to learn. That was step one. Step two was to put programs together, and a number of the groups did. Our group was one that was one of the pioneers, but we certainly aren't the only group, where we would get together and adopters could either bring their horses, or we would get together with BLM when they were offering horses and actually have hands-on sessions where people could learn to be sensitive about how they were around their horses so they didn't cause the horse to react in fear but respond in curiosity. That's how you make the connection with the horse, develop trust, and develop a partnership. And those people were hugely successful. And then the third element was basically intervention or mentor peer support. Somebody did get a horse home, is in over his or her head, is struggling. They don't have to either give up or spend a fortune, sending the horse out to be trained. Although I agree that training is a good thing, professional training is a good thing. I'm not saying that, they shouldn't, but some people weren't in a position to do that. So volunteers could assist and try to get them through some problematic issue that they were having with the horse so they could go on to the next step. That kept a lot of horses from going back to BLM. And we found two things that were very interesting. After a few years, we studied the effects of the mentoring program and the educational outreach. First, out of all the horses that we looked at, the only horse out of hundreds of horses that we were looking at that went back to BLM had a physical problem that pre-existed the adopter taking the horse, and the adopter couldn't afford to deal with it. So they took it back to BLM, and BLM dealt with it. The other thing that we discovered was with families, and we're talking about the total number of people that lived at a specific address, families that had a good first-time adoption experience, on average, over a five-year period, adopted a total average of 3.6 horses and or burros from one of the animal agencies such as BLM. That's huge brand loyalty. And what we found out was they enjoyed the experience of gentling and training the horses. Now, once they got a horse to a certain point, they gave the horse to a cousin or, what have you. They might not have kept them all personally, but all of those horses stayed in private care, and those horses stayed healthy. Those horses were cared for. But it was sort of the mindset that was what we call the good quality adopter had embraced, and the experience of working with this wild animal that the good adopter embraced that created the success here.
Well, it is certainly a fantastic opportunity, at least with all these obstacles, but there are ways. And when I was reading about Wild Horse Mentors program for horse adopters, I clearly understood that people who have, first of all, means to take care of an animal, have a passion, they have this opportunity to give this care. And I'm certainly very relieved that you gave us such comprehensive answer, because when I read this word removed, I was very much in puzzlement. What does it mean? I like to have a little spiritual break and give our wonderful guest a little moment of rest, listening to his own music. As I mentioned before, he is so gifted in so many ways. And frankly, I will confess, when I was reading this information, this overwhelmingly exciting facts about horses, I had the joy to listen to music of Willis. And then I asked him if I could play this on the air, and graciously he agreed on this. So I will follow my concept of my show, where we are all connected in what we hear, what we listen to it, and let's also exercise our imagination with this beautiful horse world, whatever we can imagine, flying with this incredibly graceful animal. So we're going to travel with that using song of Willis Lamb, which has a name, Hearts of Iron.
Hearts of iron, surviving desert heat and snow. Hooves of steel thundering across the ground below. Only moon shining down its silver line. For the wild ponies running across the Comstock tonight. Long time ago, when this land was wild and free, explorers came just to see what they could see. Conquistadors, they rode the west and claimed these lands for Spain. And a few legends from those times remain. With hearts of iron, surviving desert heat and snow. Bows of steel thundering across the ground below. A lonely moon shining down its silver light. Are the wild ponies running across the Comstock tonight? Out in Nevada in 1849, we're told, outside of Dayton, a weary traveler found some gold. Prospectors came and scoured the earth for silver, gold, and more. And they needed hardy beasts to haul their ore. With hearts of iron, surviving desert heat and snow, hooves of steel thundering across the ground below. Only moon shining down its silver pine. For the wild ponies running across the Comstock tonight. The Carson Valley is full of people, homes and cars, a super Walmart, big casino clubs and bars, people spreading everywhere. The horses have to go. How will future generations know about hearts of iron, surviving desert heat and snow? Hooves of steel thundering across the ground below. A lonely moon shining down its silver pride. Are the wild ponies running across the Comstock tonight? On Devil's Flat, December 1998, when two Marines and their buddy made a date, they snuck in close, their rifles fired, and 34 would fall. Thank God they didn't kill them all. Their hearts of iron, surviving desert heat and snow. Hooves of steel thundering across the ground below. A lonely moon shining down its silver pride. All the wild ponies running across the Comstock tonight. So through the shadows on his spirit I will ride. The lonely stallion, his mares and foals close by his side. Leave the valley for a range where horses still run free, even if it's only in my memory. Of hearts of iron, surviving desert heat and snow. Hooves of steel thundering across the ground below. A lonely moon shining down its silver pie. Are the wild ponies running across the Comstock tonight? A lonely moon, always shine your silver light on those wild bones running across the Comstock tonight.
I need to thank you so much for this beautiful song. I will take a moment and express myself as a musician. Just the phrasing, such a luscious melody, so country-like, and your performance of it as if you truly, truly belong where your world is. Can I ask you a little different question? These songs, unfortunately, we're going to hear another one a little later, but are these songs you just wrote spontaneously when you're in the field with the horses? Give us just a little bit of a feeling, a little background of this music.
Well, you know, yeah, I think, you know, spontaneity is probably the most relevant term here. You had me thinking there for a second. I didn't mean to be slow to respond. Yeah, but it just, you're out
you're
doing
only,
things.
I will bring you back to your own element. You're only human, yeah. And you are so spontaneous. And if you will be like a machine, we will not believe that you belong to the natural world. Please be yourself. We enjoy you immensely.
Well, thanks. No, you know, and that's it. We have our experiences, and just sometimes it happens. Yeah, and I've told a couple of people, you know, some of these ideas for songs, they come across in about 15 seconds. It's just there. You have the experience, and your mind just sort of assembles it. And of course, you know, working out phrasing and rhymes and cadence and everything takes a little time. But I just usually try to write about what I see or I experience. Pretty much everything that we've ever put together, with Harold Roy Miller and Lacey.
Yes,
and
we're
some
going
of our,
to. Yeah. Sorry, jumping in. We're going to have a little bit of his poem as well. I'm glad that you brought him in, and in fact, we're going to have a little music which was connected to his poem. But I will give this insert a little later. But thank you for bringing him up.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, we share a sort of a like experience. In fact, we all live out where the wild horses are, and we enjoy the Western style of music. It's a little more laid back for some folks, I suppose, but and we enjoy what we see, and we enjoy how we live out here, and it's just sort of the way we express it. And I really don't have a more coherent way of explaining it than that. It just sort of happens. But I suppose that most people that are musicians that have done composing, you know, realize that there are things that you sometimes try to construct, but there's other things that just happen. And that's where we are here out on the Wild Horse Range.
Well, honestly, you just described a process of great composers, so I will certainly, hopefully, make you feel very very happy to call as a great composer, because exactly what happens is in a true spontaneous composition is a question of the moment. And of course, yes. there is a schooling, there is some foundation, all of that comes at a certain point in the childhood. But then you go in the woods and then you meet certain moments in the nature, and here you are expressing your gift. And that's probably I was taken by your music because you brought me much closer to your world and to this grace of horses. I will certainly would not hide my enthusiasm. And again, I would say we will hear your another song. And fortunately, we will have time for this. And because of that, I will come back to our discussion about the horses. Again, we are having a program which is devoted to the world and life of horses and wild horses. And our wonderful guest is Willis Lum, whose life and gift is leading to this world of horses. We've been discussing in quite details some natural aspects of development and modern situation with the horses. And I like to address this issue from standpoint of view of just a mother nature. Why all these laws need to be so complicated and so artificially imposed in the most natural world where it should be enough space for everyone? Certainly Nevada will have enough space for all kinds of horses. So how could you again touch upon those rules and regulations?
Well, I think the simple answer is that politicians are involved. The more in-depth answer is that there are a few precious resources in Nevada. Water is one of them. And the way the laws were constructed from the very time that Nevada joined the Union was that the state, they say the public, but what they mean is the state owns all of the water in Nevada with the exception of the Colorado River, which is administered by the federal government. And because of that, the state allocates the water primarily to private interests, which, of course, in a dry state is appropriate so that theoretically there's enough water to go around. In those early days, the federal government and the Bureau of Land Management had no responsibility to monitor and to manage horse herds. And as a result, they were simply an administrator for private entities to be able to use public lands. Their position was at the time, and it made sense in 1930s, for example, that if you wanted to use the public lands, and for example, for cattle, then it was the cattle operators, the permittee's responsibility to obtain the rights to the water for his cattle. Well, in 1971, when the Bureau of Land Management all of a sudden became responsible for probably somewhere in the order of 45,000 horses and burros, they had the land and they had the animals, but they didn't legally own the water that the animals needed. So right off the from the very beginning, that started a very strange relationship where the federal agency that's managing federal lands had to more or less negotiate with the permitted users on those lands to continue to provide water for the horses that are federal property. The horses by law belong to the federal government that also reside on those federal lands. No one ever cut to the chase and straightened this thing out because, water is power in the West, and nobody was willing to try to open up that door and start a water war over horses. My personal position is that the federal government should take a little bit stronger stand, and as long as they're not unduly harming other users of a water aquifer, if there's water on or under federal land and they need it for federal activities, they should be able to use it. However, for people that are trying to acquire water rights to sell to urban areas and for energy companies and things like that, they certainly share a completely different view. So I don't see that being resolved right away. And water is just one of two or three examples of where the by being able to monopolize scarce resources, you get to actually exert a great deal of influence over policy over our public lands that really, you know, belong to 300 million people here.
In a little bit more in depth, perhaps another sensitive question, there have been allegations made that some horse removals were not necessary to maintain a thriving ecological balance, but were made to benefit specific corporate interests. Can you comment on that?
I would be happy to. Yes, this is correct. BLM, okay, there's two issues here. One is Congress says that BLM is to provide and maintain a thriving ecological balance. The other is that they are to manage the horses to the minimum, that's minimum extent necessary. So, in other words, it's a minimalist approach to managing the horses. At least that was Congress's intent. A recent court decision, and it's not the only one, but it's one of the most recent, involved the West Douglas herd in Colorado, where advocates challenged in court the fact that there was not justification to remove a large number, and perhaps the total number of horses on this particular herd area, in order to preserve a thriving ecological balance. What they needed to do is they needed to remove the horses to make it easier on a mining company to deal with things. And the court basically ruled that BLM was not allowed to do that, and that they had exceeded the agency had exceeded its authority. And these are, you know, when you see issues where it seems like every time you turn around, there's some interest group, an environmental group or a watershed group or the horse advocacy group suing the federal government over management decisions, it usually boils back to is the agency following the conditions set by law for them to take an action, or have they been influenced and they are making decisions that don't follow the law? You have to remember that the Bureau of Land Management falls under the Department of Interior, the same agency that is responsible for the Minerals Management Service, who is responsible for allowing the chain of events that culminated in the disaster that we had out in the Gulf. So these things do happen in these complex bureaucracies, and unfortunately, our current administration is not, in my opinion, adequately focused on having these agencies follow the straight and narrow path. So it invites, for example, legal challenges, of which everybody in government seems to complain, every time I turn around, I'm being sued. Well, follow the law and you won't be. It's kind of my point.
I think your colleague, Karen Sussman, also was involved in some legal issues, and she also had to be extremely powerful in proving how these allegations and all these broken rules and imposition on Mother Nature, frankly, cruelty, had to be exposed so public will be aware of it.
Yes, you know, and first of all, it's not real easy to take a government agency to court. There are many hurdles that are placed there to prevent frivolous court actions, you know, from tying up government agencies forever, because no matter what you're doing, there's going to be somebody that's not happy about it. However, for example, in Karen's case and several of the others in defense of animals and a few other agencies interest groups that went after some of the agencies, it was necessary to resort to these kinds of actions because, you know, number one, I don't think that it's a bad thing that public resources are made available through permits and fee structures for private enterprises to make use of. You know, we need a healthy business environment which creates healthy employment, which creates a healthy middle class, which will creates a healthy economy. But where we end up having problems and where Karen and the other groups get concerned, and eventually if they can't solve the problem, go to court, is we can't let some of these interests sort of be the tail that wags the dog. The dog is our government. It's our public lands. The dog dictates where the tail wags, and we really got to get back to that. I think that's going to solve a lot of problems. But you've got huge corporations that have a lot of money invested in a lot of politicians. So I have a feeling that we're going to be in court for a while longer.
I will make last question before we will hear another piece of music.
Sure.
And the question is regarding going green. When I was acquainting myself with this problem, I was thinking, would it be logical to merge these challenges with a general world and USA issue to go green?
Well, I think that at some point that has to happen. You know, we have to go more green. You know, they keep saying they're finding more fossil fuels and they'll figure out how to burn coal clean and so forth. But, you know, there's only so much out there. And sooner or later, our rate of consumption is going to exceed the supply, and that's going to drive prices way up, and that's going to tank our economy again. So realistically, we have to look for alternatives. Obviously, not wasting energy is a big one. That's something we can all do. There's times that we can cut back on what we consume. The other options, such as wind and solar generation, they show a lot of promise. The one thing that we have to manage carefully is a lot of the areas that are conducive to wind generation and to solar generation are in the middle of fairly fragile ecosystems. Just less than a quarter mile from my house are wagon ruts on the desert that were left by the pioneers that were going to California, you know, during the Great Migration, before and during the Gold Rush. Those wagon ruts are there. How many years have gone by? So there are things that we do that impact the range that last for generations. So I think what we have to do here, and it's not just the Western United States, I think from a global standpoint, we need to take a look at our resources, our new technologies, and the risks that are involved. And we need to establish a common sense and I don't mean to come off, you know, like an extremist, but an environmentally sensitive approach to developing some of these alternatives, because there are areas where the environment is extremely fragile. I'm not saying that, you know, everything has to be in a beautifully tied box or something, but you know, we have to use some common sense. And sometimes we get a little bit too enthusiastic about developing certain new technologies or new industries or things that can affect us, you know, without taking in the total picture. So, you know, we don't want to just stand and let the world go by and realize that we've run out of resources. But on the other side, we need to have a discussion. We need to have the debate. I think one of the things that's healthy about our country is, you know, they're going to put a pipeline across the West, or they're going to take millions of acres and put up solar panels. We're going to have a discussion and a debate about it. As long as that debate and those issues can be honest and not be choreographed, I have a feeling that we've got a fair chance under those circumstances of coming up with some solutions that, you know, where we don't have to throw away our wildlife, we don't have to throw away our watersheds, we don't have to throw away the wild horses in order to solve another particular problem that we're all concerned with.
Well, this balance which you're talking about, and you've been so beautifully crafted at the moment when you talk about getting a little bit more enthusiastic about new technical invention, and yet we definitely have to be now more cautious and not to go to one extreme at the expense of another one. Well, this balance, invisible balance, nothing can express this better than the music. And again, what a wonderful bridge to go to your second song. And before, I will remind to our listeners that this is BBS Radio, whom I actually did not think enough in the beginning of the program. I'm taking my opportunity to do so now. with this beautiful song of our guest who wrote this song and gave the name Wild of Horses, if I said it correctly. So, Willis, please correct me if I didn't pronounce correctly the name of your song. Is that Wild of Horses or just Wild Horses?
Wild Horses, yeah. Wild Horses.
Wild right. Horses. Yeah. Apologizing for this little extension. With that, please enjoy this beautiful song by Willis Lum.
Hearts of iron, surviving desert heat and snow, blows of steam, thundering across the ground below, a lonely moon, shining down its silver line, while the wild ponies running across the Comstock tonight, long time ago, when this land was wild and free, explorers came, just to see what they could see. Conquistadors, they wrote the West and claimed these lands for Spain. And a few legends from those times remain. Hearts of iron.
And that was a mistake of mine. I fell in love with Hearts of Iron, the first song of Willis Lum. That by mistake, but what a wonderful mistake, we put that song for the second time. So, but I do not want to deprive anyone. So this is indeed Wild Horses song by Willis Lum.
Every day, every night, seems like all we ever do is fight.
It goes on day after day until you finally get your way.
Maybe it's time I should get out of this place, go rejoin the human race.
If it seems I bug you so, then I guess that you should go.
Wild horses, wild horses,
do, 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 do.
Wild horses. Can bring me back to you.
Do, 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 do.
Wild horses. Wild horses.
Do, 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 do.
Wild horses. Can bring me back to you.
It's the evil spell you weave that makes me want to leave. Our romance is heading south. Thanks to your contentious mouth.
Well, if you do just one thing right, we wouldn't always have to fight. I wouldn't growl like a bear if you'd show a little care.
Wild horses, wild horses, wild horses, can drag me back to you. Wild horses, wild horses, wild horses, can drag me back to you.
That old
she was bred to be the boss. Maybe the things wild horses do should be the way for me and you. Wild horses, wild horses, wild horses will bring me back to you. Wild horses, wild horses, wild horses will bring me back to you.
Well, I wish you would be here and to see the reaction. We all had this wild horses dance right here in my studio. What a pleasure that was. I think we covered, at least from my end, the most essential issues, at least for this program. I think we still have time, and frankly, I wanted to talk a little bit about my area where I live, which is East Coast. And if you know anything about our horse life, which I happen to be involved just a little bit, just with two friends of mine who have their horses in upstate New York. And I know how much they treasure every weekend when they go there, because this is their true vacation and spiritual recharging moment. But that's an emotional part of it. If you could share some of the thoughts of your knowledge about the East Coast horse life, any recommendation or anything, any kind of a message you can express, we like to know.
Well, ironically, the East Coast is actually pretty big on wild horses, even though you wouldn't think so. Aside from the Chincoteague ponies and, you know, the Barrier Island horses, the East Coast is a huge adoption market, for lack of a better term, for America's wild horses, those horses that have had to be removed and that have gone through the adoption program. The Bureau of Land Management has the country divided into different sections. And, of course, the eastern states, since there's not a lot of federal public range lands, you know, across the eastern seaboards, those states are all grouped together in one group called eastern states. Eastern states consume sounds like we're eating them. They receive and find homes for more horses than any of the other divisions within the Bureau of Land Management. So while we probably are the ones out here that grow the horses, and of course we have the unique, you talk about something that's spiritual, go ride your Mustang out among the bands of Mustangs, you know, and be surrounded by them, and that's just totally incredible. But you can still have the Mustang experience, because BLM brings horses to the East Coast through two ways. One is through an internet adoption, where you can adopt horses off the internet. They have usually hundreds of horses to choose from, and what they'll do is they'll bring the horses out to the BLM facility that's the closest to the adopter. And then the Milwaukee field office that handles the Northeast, and I realize Wisconsin's a little west for you eastern seaboard folks, but they're actually the home office that handles the entire Northeast. They do have satellite adoptions where they bring horses out to different eastern states, all the way up as far as Maine sometimes, to be available for adopters. Now, even if you're not planning to take a horse home, these are very interesting situations or events that you can go out and see what a wild horse looks like before it's been gentled, talk to people that have adopted the horses, just kind of get a sense of what these animals are like, and actually lay eyes on a horse that grew up out in the wild here in the western states. They're all over the East Coast, and it's an adventure that many Easterners love, and we do get a lot of Easterners that, because of their experiences with domestic horses and with sometimes with adopted wild horses, they got to come out west and see where these horses actually originated from and how they lived in environments that are not overly manipulated by humans. So, you know, there is an across-the-country connectivity here. It doesn't matter if you're in the tip of Florida or up at the tip of Maine or in New York City. In fact, there's actually adopters of wild horses within the limits of the District of Columbia. So D.C. even has adopted horses. You know, it's pretty amazing. It is an American icon, and enjoying these horses is a uniquely American pastime.
Well, I certainly feel that we can have another artistic inversion today, having poetry. And then after this, we will have a piece of music which was inspired by this poetry. And then we will come back to my guest, Willis Lum, and I will ask him a few questions about world issue with the horses. We did touch upon this in the beginning, but I very much like to know his general view and perhaps international collaboration in our modern world. Now we are shifting again. We're traveling from information and this just endless thoughts and such a wonderful ideas which Willis was generously shared with us. And we will continue that on a very special poem which was written by a friend and a colleague of Willis Lum. It's written by Harold Rowe Miller. I hope one day to have him as my guest as well. But now I will allow myself to take a moment and recite his moment of the poem and recite particularly beautiful words and picturesque emotions which he was able to express in his words. Not that the rest of the poem is less expressive, but that particularly took my soul. I admired their sure-footedness and survival skills as they followed the boss mare up the rocky hills. The stallion was lost and he brought up the rear. It was a protective maneuver and not out of fear. It was an inspiring scene to watch the band flee, but a wistful melancholy feeling overwhelmed me. The Mustangs, like the cowboy, symbol of the Old West, drifted into the sunset and vanished over the crest.
Yeah, that's Harold. He's pretty darn good at expressing what he sees.
He really is. And I would not hide. And I would say that very talented composer who is nice enough to compose many songs for my shows was inspired enough to compose very quickly his own version of this beautiful description of the horses. Let's hear music by Julian Lampert, who will share with us image and grace of this beautiful poem, which leads us to think about horses. We're taking this little pause, and I like to ask nothing specific at this point, but just to share with us last thought, which will conclude our program. And that thought I like to just address as my spontaneous desire to give an opportunity to Willis to express his thought, his feelings, and his dream for the future of wild horses around the world.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to say that that was a very interesting piece of music. I would not be surprised if that had been composed out at, for example, at sunrise on the Wild Horse Range. It's just, you know, there was some good soul there. I just wanted to comment favorably on that.
Thank you so much. I will transmit your comments. Thank you. It means a lot to me.
Oh, great. Oh, I appreciate that. Back to horses. Yes, we need to catch up with the protection of our horses. You know, there are wild horses in a lot of other countries, and we didn't get too deeply into that because we can go off in a whole host of different directions. In some respects, we're a little bit behind the curve in how we manage our resources and we manage our wild horses in the West. I think that, as you yourself pointed out, the West is very large, and we do have resources. If they're managed correctly, there is sufficient room for everyone out here. We just have to kind of get our priorities straight, and we also have to use a little more common sense. Than our joke out here is common sense isn't very common, and I think the best way to do that is to remind our legislators that we do have some values. We do value some of our historical things. We do value our traditional iconic items, whether they be wild horses or any of a number of other things that I'm sure everybody can bring to mind. We need to move forward into the future, but we can't do that at the expense of connecting with our past. America's wild horses, traditionally, throughout the last few decades, major polls have shown that two-thirds of the American public, between two-thirds and 70% actually, support the preservation of wild horses, because there is this sort of spiritual and visual connectivity to our past. They should be out there for anyone who wants to enjoy them, because they also represent our historic public lands, all of the other things that as people who like to do outdoor activities and enjoy recreation and so forth, as go the horses, go a lot of these other opportunities. We can't close the lands to the horses. We can't close the lands to the public. These are our lands, and the horses have been there for a long time. We all agree they need to be there. As far as the day-to-day issues that affect wild horses, the best thing we all can do is contact our legislators. You know, they are concerned about how we feel because they're concerned about election time, and remind them that these preserving our public lands for the public and preserving things like the wild horses on our public lands are important to us. If they are important to us and we express that, then they are going to be important to many of the legislators in Congress. Now, they're important to us, they're important to me, not just for my own enjoyment, to be able to go out, because I'm fortunate enough to live out here, but they're important to our future, our children, our grandchildren. They should be able to have some connectivity to our history. You know, we're a modern country. You go to areas of Europe and Asia, you know, those folks over there look back thousands of years. You know, we're only looking back a couple hundred. We need to get our preservation of our history in order, so 1,000 years from now, people can look around and still see things that are representative of where we came from and what brought us to where we are. And on a maybe a spiritual sense, I guess, what brought us to who we are. And I think these are important. One other little thing I'd like to plug in here is that while obviously, we want to protect and preserve these horses on the public lands and on our western ranges as much as we can. We know they're going to increase in their population, and even under the best of circumstances, the Bureau of Land Management and the other agencies are going to be bringing horses in, and they're going to be offering them to the public, even if you never intended to take a horse home. There is a website where you can find out what kind of activities are going on near you. By the way, New Yorkers, since you're in upstate New York, have adopted nearly 1,500 horses during the life program. That's a lot of horses. So there are wild horses amongst us, no matter where we live, with the exception of Hawaii. And you can find out where horses might be available for adoption, to at least see them and see what this whole thing's all about. The best website to get to, and it's going to redirect you to a web address that's way too complicated to try to remember over the radio. It's wildhorseandburrow.bom.gov. That's Wild Horse and Burrow with the and spelled out, A-N-D, in between horse and burrow, .blm.gov. That brings you to the BLM's Wild Horse and Burrow program. Of course, it's their spin on what this program is all about. But it gives you a chance to see where you can see horses, either in the wild or that are being made available to adopters, and to kind of just learn more about the issues, because there are multiple sides to this issue. You need to learn. We need to articulate our concerns to the people that we elect, and we need to sustain what I feel are, you know, some of the last vestiges of the wild and free West that we have among us.
The issue of finding you, it's so critically important. I just wanted to sneak one more question before the conclusion of our program. Are there some kind of a family resorts near places where especially children can see these beautiful animals? Are there any kind of a public places where maybe for entertainment or some kind of training or little lessons, people can take their time, their one-day trip, or spend vacation? Are those places indicated on a website, which I will ask you kindly to repeat again?
Okay. You know, that's a good question. I know because the whole issue is so diverse and there's so many different organizations involved that I know that there are locations. I'm not sure about necessarily, you know, New York, but the Neda Park in near Chicago, there, the Kentucky Horse Park, there are different venues where they have a variety of different horse programs, including wild horses. And in fact, there are actually equine facilitated therapy programs for the disabled youngsters. Some of them use wild horses because the mares are very protective. You know, if they're gentled and trained correctly, they're very protective of the kids. You know, so those opportunities do exist. What I would suggest is if you get onto the Bureau of Land Management website, there are usually contacts. And you can look for an office that's reasonably close to your location. Try to reach somebody at that office and find out what's going on that would be appropriate for the youth to come see. Now, if you're in Nevada, it'd be real easy for me to give you some ideas, or even in California. The East Coast is certainly sort of a little bit farther out of my direct view. But the website, again, is wildhorseandburrow.blm.gov. And I'll tell you, one of the things I'll try to do is, and we occasionally have some things listed, but this is something we probably ought to focus on, try to get network with some of the other horse groups and see what activities are coming up. The Wild Horse Mentors website is www.whmentors.org. And I'll make it a point in the next few days to see what I can come up with as far as activities that are going to be taking place later on in the year that involve wild horses, where the public and particularly youth could come and see what's going on. Because, yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm an adult and I think in terms of adults, but, you know, the kids are our future and they need to get amped up about this stuff too.
Absolutely. And my just a little addition of my fantasy, why don't we have some music country festival in one of those locations where you live? On this note of my fantasy, I think we came to the end of this program, but certainly not to the end of this just a wonderful opening. I cannot thank enough our beautiful guest, Willis Lum. Wanted to thank him for sharing, for giving so clear on even some complicated subjects. And I do hope that this is first note we play together on the air. I'm very much looking forward to a few more, to more of your songs. And on this note, I want to jointly to thank BBS, again, this wonderful staff who was particularly so kind to us, giving us extra time and this wonderful experience with World of Horses, with the music which we heard by Willis Lum, Julian Lampert, and myself, who is your host, Lena Life. On this note, I will say goodbye, and I hope to see you next Tuesday at 4 o'clock. ¶¶